have a little bit of time for questions. I'm going to maybe ask each one of you my favorite question that I've been longing to ask you for months and months, and then open it up to you as well as the audience to ask questions. And so my first question is going to be for Don, and it's a little bit of a selfish question, but hopefully something that will be enlightening for everybody, which is, what would your advice be for young people who are beginning their careers as choral conductors, or who are considering choral conducting as a vocation, and particularly in New England?
Well, my first response, which is silly, is find another career. The second response would be, I don't know, because I think the choral movement, as I have known it, is changing radically, and primarily because the audience is falling off. There are just more singers than listeners. So I don't know what advice I would give. My advice would be very sure this is what you want to do. As someone once said, if you can think of any other career that you could be in, go to it. But if you have to be in this career, then be the best that you can be in.
And in terms of specialization and the need for specialization as a result of audience drop-off, do you see any, certainly you've opened up avenues for specialization for people in the field. Do you envision any other additional fields of specialization developing in the next decades?
Well, I wish I'd done more. I said in my opening remarks, I think there is an opening for small specialized groups, 15, 20, even 30 singers, who devote themselves to a specific period or a specific repertoire, Bach cantatas, you know, or whatever, you know, Renaissance motets. There are groups like that are very good right now, and I think there's room more, and they do well in terms of audiences too. So that's what I was. I just got to say one thing though in response to what Joey was saying. When I was 19 years old, I was hired as organist at St. Andrew's Church just down the street, and it was a fluke. I should never have been hired for that job because I had no experience. Things were different in those days, and I went into that, and there was a junior choir of about 90 kids, 80 to 90 kids during the whole 10 years I was there. And the first rehearsal was a shambles because the mothers were patrolling up and down the aisle, trying to discipline the kids. And I said, I called the mothers together after the rehearsal, and I said, I would like there to be only one person in the room, one mother who takes attendance. Let me work with the kids. And all of a sudden it changed. You know, you sometimes had this educating at home. But we had such a wonderful time. I learned more from that experience, and I apply lessons that I learned in that experience that I have applied throughout my whole career. That's a sidebar.
Thank you, Don. And it's hard because I have at least 20 questions for each one of these people. But for Richard, I'm wondering, why are you stealing my stuff, Nick?
What's these questions?
You want to pick your own questions? Okay. Too bad for Rick, huh? What type of a vision do you have for New England's professional and semi-professional choruses over the next 50 years in terms of specialization and also financial support? And do you ever encounter a conflict in terms of programming between what is supportable and what your professional musicians are interested in doing?
That's a really good one, isn't it? Thank you. I think, let's see, 50 years, I'll be 113. Well, anyway, I probably won't be there. But nonetheless, I think what we need to rejoice in is the fact that there are great, and we've heard this from the panelists, great composers are still there, they're still being born. The Lawrences and the Eric Whitakers and even Ned Roram at 85. So we need to be looking at what is coming out, new talent, regardless of what the ages are. And I do think that inspires and invigorates people. I would also say, despite the plethora of electronic gadgetry that is surrounding us, and I use it all myself, I think it's really important that we try to restore acoustic singing in this generation and the next singing. Yes. Next generation. Thank you. I had lunch with a dear colleague this week, and he's so excited about his new programming, which is that there will be no printed programs. The audience is expected to bring in an iPad. They will have this light in their face as they're looking. And he says, and if they want to, when we're singing a hymn to St. Cecilia, Britain, he said, if they decide during the singing they want to look up more about Auden, they can do that while they're listening to music. Well, my stomach was like in a knot. I thought, this is the worst thing I've ever heard. But I do know that there is this rage for electronic wizardry and gadgetry, and I'm opposed to it in the public forum. I'm in favor of it privately. And so I think one of the things perhaps in the next generation or two is just to remember why Carnegie Hall sounds good, and why St. John the Divine has 9 seconds of reverberation, and you can't replicate much of that with all the electronics. So I would say new composers, new sounds, but let's see what Mother Nature has to say to us and not what General Electric does.
Thank you.
Unless the stockholders for General Electric here, I apologize.
Now, after stealing my questions, Nick has decided that I do indeed get to pick. So, my favorite questions for Nick are really all in the same vein, but I'd like to hear you talk, Nick, about what our primary ethical obligations are as choral musicians and how that might shape music over the next 50 years, and how can we be activists as choral musicians, and how can we support our activism?
Well, as all of us have said today, we have to have the highest standards in what we do. We have to encourage the young people to compose. I also am a firm believer in just the acoustic experience of singing. But at the same time, I acknowledge that Eric Whitaker and his virtual choir movements.
Yeah.
Is something that should not be ignored. That's what I personally believe. It's not. It's in its infancy now. It's where people line up, go on the web, and they sing a choral piece on the web live. Okay, you know, it'll never replace the actual experience of being in a hall. But I think it is, you know, good or bad, it's part of our future. For me. I learned from my father the concept of reciprocal altruism. When you do good things happen in return. When you do bad things happen in return. So for me, just the act of doing good things, of singing well, of giving everything you have to an audience and just shining with all your light, that to me is something which comes back a thousandfold. And it spreads in a wonderful, wonderful way. And so in terms of advocacy and ethics, very much that concept that everything we do has a good effect in this world, or should have a good effect. I applaud your work next week with raising money for Japan. That's just a wonderful, wonderful thing. My chorus a few years ago worked with some South African musicians, and we gave 400 tickets to a group called Sibo Sisu, and they sold them, and they raised about $10,000 for an AIDS orphanage in South Africa. So that's part of the work we do, and it's an important part of it. So it's becoming, you know, chorus has started here, but now we're part of a greater world. We're part of a huge universe. And feeling that connection is, for me, paramount.
Well, and I get to ask Jody questions all the time, so this might be unfair. But Jody, do you have you ever found that programming in a way that gets children and audience excited about the music conflicts with your own artistic vision and your own vision as an artist?
I don't think so. I'm not going to stand up.
I can ask you a better question if you want.
I think there's such a fine that you have to be so careful to not be, when you're working with children, to avoid gimmicks. It's cheap gimmicks that, yes. I've been known to use them, shamelessly manipulative gimmicks. But you really don't want to to trick the audience into emoting or being moved. You want to actually connect with them. So audiences sometimes don't like new pieces. Adult choruses often don't like being presented with brand new pieces to do. Usually, if you're doing a new piece, if you select a new piece, it hasn't been written, but you've had enough of part of the process that it's not in conflict with you. You figure out a way that what the heck they were trying, this poor tortured composer soul was trying to say, and then you help them, and you're the conduit for them. Sometimes I remember when we did Voice of Isaac, that was my most tortured commission ever. Howie Friesen wrote it. It got published by Peters. That's the most successful one too. I think it was a beautiful concert, but it was such an upsetting piece. It was again, and the sound world that Howie writes is not my, it's not natural with my sound world. So I had to work really hard. The subject was awful. It was about, and I loved the subject. It was about what is Isaac thinking as his father's about to murder him, kill him, because God's up there going, "You go kill your son." And it was so sophisticated, and it was so disturbing, and the words were just disturbing. Robert Honeysucker was Abraham, and well, that's another whole story. But he didn't know it was hard until like one day before, and so we had to bring him up to speed quickly. Because he thought it was just a children's piece, and all of a sudden he's like, oh. So that's how I got to know him at his house. And he came up and sang in Hancock the other week. We're very good friends, but that was an experience. But anyway, that sound was again, and the whole nature of it was sort of against everything, all my little Pollyanna-ness about me. But now when I listen to it, I think, oh my God, that was incredible. I can't believe I did that. And I'm really proud I did. He wanted to do it in about one month later. He said, "Let's do it again." I'm like, I can't do that again. It's just too hard. Too hard on my spirit, sort of, because that's how different. But the audience, most of them really liked it. We got reviewed by Dyer, and he thought it was really good. I think it was a good piece, but it was the hardest one for me. It wasn't my taste, although I'm the one that loved the subject. I thought, whoa, we'll get to that. Whoa, this is good. Yay, children. You know, so it was challenging.
Thanks, Jody. And for all of you panelists, how can an organization such as Kane that has decisions to make and funds to distribute support your visions for the next 50 years in New England? Anybody gets to answer that wants to.
Just support Boston Cecilia.
No brainer, right?
I would say, you know, support the next generation, and not just PALS and the mm-hmm. and Boston Children's Chorus doesn't need any more money. And I love them, please. I love them. support the next generation.
I actually have a serious response to that too. My own view is that it might be better to give fewer grants with more money, because mm-hmm. every course is facing the same problems. If you have doing a piece with orchestra, or just the cost of presenting concerts are so great that I think that it might serve the cause better to do that.
About fewer grants, each grant being larger.
Larger, yes.
What is a
go? Yeah, go ahead. Let's open it up to the audience.
Grant. I know that goes across the gamut, but
how many dollars?
What is a meaningful grant in terms of today's performance?
Considering the scale that Kane is working within, a grant is $3,000 to $5,000 is substantial.
Is it meaningful, though? Is it enough?
It's not enough to cover a concert.
No, but I mean, should we be considering $7,500? What are the kinds of things that? No, but I mean, what sorts of what gets sacrificed for that, and what?
I think the more that you give for to individual groups, the better. I don't actually know what the scale of availability of funds is now. I used to, but yes, and the more important Kane is to the presentation. $1,000 or $2,000 is not really, doesn't pay anything.
A grant the size of $5,000, somebody used that number, that can be an amount that determines whether or not the event even happens.
Okay.
So then you're at the level of making of truly underwriting a true partnership, sponsorship, a make it or break it. It's a, kind of a critical number there, I would say.
The questions related to relevance in these, I think one of the big concerns was how many people are attending the events. And you know, how do you spark that attendance? And is there any spark it with relevance of the concerts or the connecting with society or the responsibility of social change? Now I must admit my brain is on this tack because Thursday night I saw a documentary on Phil Oakes, the famous 60s, 70s folk singer. So my brain is kind of on that tack right now. But kind of all, everything's political in life. And so I hate to put it that way, but how do you spark their relevance back to society where they want to come see the concerts, and why should they?
Well, I could say something, but I've been talking too much. I would just give you an anecdote. For 30 years, a member of the Cecilia Chorus was Stephen Jay Gould, a paleontologist and baseball fan and all kinds of other things. Steve said that he liked Handel and Wagner because they were long enough so that he could actually get into the experience of the performance before it ended, which was the case with most concerts. So Steve Gould was a member of our board, and he said, whenever financial questions came up, he said, we are committed to presenting the highest art of European and American culture. That's our responsibility. When we can't do that anymore, let's stop. And I, from my point of view, that's what we're about. Audiences, yes, we want audiences, and yes, we'll keep trying to get them to find what, you know, to respond to what we consider relevance, but what our particular goal is that. And other groups may choose other goals, which is fine, but our goal was that, and has remained that.
So how do you get your audience back to your part of life, your part of the music history?
What we do the best that we can do, and assume that word of mouth and reviews and other things will persuade an audience that they ought to come and try it. It's not always successful. These days, even the Boston Symphony has empty seats, which was unheard of when I was a student in Boston. So I don't know.
There are groups like, in Philadelphia, a group called Singing City.
Yeah.
Jeffrey Brilhart, director. And they're a wonderful adult chorus, audition chorus. They do all the great masterpieces. What's special about them is that they decided 50 years ago they were going to be an urban chorus and that they were not going to bring people to them. They were going to go to people, okay? And so they go to schools. Small groups will go to schools. They'll start chamber choirs in schools. They always do a high school festival every year where they invite local high school kids from the urban schools to come together. In other words, they make it part of their mission statement to foster that next generation and to bring great music to people, regardless of their culture, regardless of their culture. A chorus I direct, the Mystic Chorale, I would love to do something like that, Mr. Board Member, but that's but that's a whole other matter. I can't get my board to go along with me on this. It's a little issue I have. We all have issues. I love my board.
Do that. Al Hyde sends professional singers out among the kids in
that's
the
right.
schools of Lawrence Hall.
That's right.
It's wonderful.
That's
do
right.
And they hear, they get a vision of
yep.
what it could be.
Yep.
They get it in their heads.
That's
hear.
Right.
I'm on the board of Monadnock Music. Anyway. And Jim Boley, has anyone heard of Jim
yeah.
Boley? He was the founder of that about 42 years ago. And we're always talking about audience, and it's dwindling, it seems to be, and it's at least it looked to me like it wasn't that big. And according to Jim and Jocelyn, it's actually the same. It was always small. And
I thought that was sort of an interesting fact. I thought, really? So it's not, it hasn't gone down? Oh, no. And I said, what about age? And up there in Hancock, we go to the opera broadcasts, the ones that the Met broadcast down. And the entire theater of about 200 seats or so is full every single time with people that make Rick and I look like we're freshmen in college. We look so young compared to everyone else. It's incredible how many people who are retired are the audiences right now, which means that you have to make sure they know things are going on, because they really do. They love coming to concerts, and then you have to be patient with the young ones, feed them money, commissions, experiences, conductors, and then wait until they get older, and then they'll start coming to concerts. But it's interesting. That's, it's not.
Well, they may not.
They might. I hope they will.
You still have to do it.
Did you have a question?
Yeah, I just want to say I'm a composer, so I'm very hard to hear what everyone is saying about, you know, supporting composers and as a young composer as well. That's great. My question is, we've talked a little bit about audiences declining and so forth, and just now talking about older audiences. And we've mentioned technology too, and while I agree that technology can be living on the edge, right, a balance of it can be dangerous, it can be great. YouTube and things like that, don't you think they could reach those younger audiences that we're trying to attract? I think it's a greater benefit to getting there than it is to detract them. So, I mean, someone could find out about choral music through YouTube that had no...
I think the whole YouTube choral thing is in its infancy. My chorus, we're making our first video this Tuesday. And so we're going to put it up on YouTube, and it's going to be fun. But it's in its infancy, and there's a lot of potential for growth, but it will never replace standing in a room and singing with others.
But you know what swept YouTube this past Christmas was the mall where the Hallelujah chorus was spontaneous, which was not, I guess, spontaneous.
Or the monks holding up the words.
Yes.
Yes. I want to say that sometimes it's self-defeating. If we say, well, most audiences aren't going to like classical music, that's kind of self-defeating, right. Very much. Artie, you were there the other day at our rehearsal with the basses, and there's one bass in my chorus with Down syndrome. Now, we're a non-audition chorus, so the expectation is he has Down syndrome, you can't make him sing in tune. That's not my expectation. My expectation is everyone can sing in tune. If you can hear, you can sing in tune. And Artie, you watched. We worked on it, and eventually he matched pitch, okay? So a lot of times our expectations are they won't come. But you have to change that mentality. It's a hard thing to do. It's a very hard thing to do. But there are choruses that are doing their music, and choruses and symphonies that are doing their music in different ways that are drawing people in. I was in Miami recently. The New World Symphony down there packs the house every concert. They have a new hall designed by Frank Gehry with monitors throughout the place. So the audience can see on the screens these images, close-ups of the bassoon player playing, and images of nature and other images that relate to the music. And they're just packing the place every week. I met someone in Colorado last year who does a chorus where there is never a dead space in the concert. In other words, the piece will end, there'll be applause, and then someone will do a dance, or someone will read a poem. And it'll just be a very natural flowing event. And I asked him, why do you do that? And he said, we respect our audience, that we're never going to ask them to sit there and do nothing. We're going to keep them involved from the very moment they walk in there with this experience of art, with this experience of human expression.
Yeah, like Phil with Dudamel is having said, you can't get a ticket.
Oh, that's right.
I've heard about this organization. How can I get a ticket to Dudamel? She lives in.
Yep.
She was supposed to go there.
Well, his magic is good old fashioned South American passion, you know, and not letting the orchestra get away with playing like certain orchestras that I won't mention.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would, I hear you saying, be in love with what you do, and that will translate. And,
my kind of soul.
You know, having been in administrative positions in a couple of different courses, you just bang your head against the wall saying, okay, we need to have an advertising strategy, we need to get out there, we need to it will infect other people.
And don't be embarrassed about it. Yeah.
Well, that's what Dudamel reflects.
That's one of the things that's most impressive about La Sistema, out of which Dudamel spawned, is that they teach inspiration. And all my life, I've tried to figure out why it is that we don't talk about that in conservatories and schools of music and high schools. But there should be so much more talk about how you connect the music to the soul and what it means and why we do it. And if you don't do that, you can't expect people to want to come out.
And you go down there, I haven't been there, but that's a very musical culture.
Yeah.
There's policemen's choruses, teachers' choruses, and they don't rehearse once a week, they rehearse four nights a week. And there are thousands and thousands, and people play in orchestras, they play in bands, they sing in choruses. I've heard it's like two-thirds of adults in this one country there are involved with music in some way or another. That's what I heard. Maybe it's not true.
Well, on that note, oh, Peter.
Just make a comment and a question. I have so many things I want to say, so I probably will say nothing. But I was very struck. I think what Don started talking about, you know, is what happened in this country about 50 years ago when there was this wave of excitement for choral music. And it seems to me, I sang in Washington with a group that started about the same time 50 years ago or so. There's in Rochester, New York, where I grew up, there's a group like that. It's everywhere, it seems like. All of a sudden, maybe this bit of people coming back from the war and highly educated or more mature people who got excited about this thing, there was just a wave of enthusiasm for choral music, and it seems to have crested. And now we have so many people who are enthusiastic about singing, and the culture is not necessarily, in other words, where the audience is. They've moved on to maybe other things. There's still plenty of audiences out there. Just dividing them up among all these enthusiastic choruses, certainly Boston. You panelists, I think, you might not agree that this is crested because you're all so successful. You've got excellent choruses. I mean, Rick Coffey, you started off, you started with one chorus, now you've got three choruses, you've got four choruses, counting the Main Street Singers, and they're all growing. So you found the secret for how to make it work. And I do think one of the things that I've learned here is the importance of engaging composers in making relationships with them. That's what you all said. But it's very risky. I know from working in a chorus, it's very risky to commission a piece and to perform a piece because how can you get people excited about wanting to hear it? They don't know who that person is unless he's one of these very expensive superstar composers.
I think that's why it's so good with children to do it, and not having babyish things being written, but sophisticated things. But they're usually not as expensive, and they're a perfect lab. Children are for new music, perfect, and not used nearly enough.
One comment I want to make is we need people like you to lead the way and impress audiences, and make audiences excited about choral singing. Ever since I heard Robert Cormier was given a Alfred F. Pettis Lifetime Achievement Award, and he's still alive. going on Don's comment about it doesn't mean anything that you're going to get a lifetime. It only means that you are very well accomplished.
To answer your first question, though, the problem is in education, and that comes down to politics. You know, and with the popularity of the program, the Glee program, which I've seen on television, which gives a false picture of what serious music can be.
Was that important to Bud Patterson that he have an educational establishment behind him?
I'm talking about elementary and secondary education.
Early stage.
And I had, in Oklahoma and Missouri, I had fantastic musical training in public school.
Somebody told me the other day that Glee has, even though it isn't exactly what we might think is what would do it, it's brought a lot of boys back into high school chorus.
But I just wanted to say, Robert DeCormier gave a good talk about the importance of professional ensembles and how it was what a great service they did to the choral community, and that always that stuck in my head, and perhaps that is what we are seeing a little bit of leadership from professional choral ensembles, and maybe that's what we should look forward to. I'm just saying a lot of the ideas that came to me and that I came in here
Yeah.
But maybe Rick, did you want to say anything about that?
Just a couple of quickies. I'll stand up because I'm the shortest one here. I assume you're a board member. I appreciate your question about how do we develop audiences, how do we guarantee. I think one of the answers to that is always be sure that the audience trusts what they're going to hear. Build a reputation, either as the conductor or the chorus or the selection of the repertoire, that the audience will come no matter what, that we don't let them down. And if we don't let them down, then I do think they will come. I have three bullet points. That's number one, real quick. I love YouTube. So when I talked about acoustic versus electronic, it wasn't anti-YouTube. I think YouTube is a great tool, and I think it is enhancing our audiences. When I put a piece of music out in the hands of the chorale or anybody, next thing I know is 20 people have called me to say what version they're listening to, what version they're seeing, and which one that they love. So I think it's a great tool. The third bullet point is what I call been calling the hallelujah effect. And that is that hallelujah chorus that you were talking about. I'm sure all of you have seen that. 2 points about that. One thing is it was allegedly spontaneous. That was the term we've been using. But you know they practiced hard for that. It was flawless. It was fantastic. And you can't watch that without bursting into tears by the end of that, all these people singing. So I think that helped turn audiences around. But the other thing is, I don't know if you've noticed this, but I think as a result of that, commercials, have you noticed how many commercials have choirs in them? And maybe it's the Glee impact as well, Brian, I'm not sure. But it is interesting to me that choral music is in the commercial world now, I believe, more than it ever was. Now, we can debate whether it's good or not, but I just love knowing that Carmina Burana is selling Hondas or something. And there are a few more pieces besides Carmina, you're right. There are a few more.
I think we might be able to take one more question before we go into our transitional song from Nick Page. And what is your...
I don't necessarily have a question. I just want to answer something Peter said. I'm Andrea Goodman. I'm from the western end of the state. Tanglewood is my backyard. And I think that if you ask any of the companies, the theater companies, the dance companies, we have lots of culture in the western part of the state, they'll all say the same thing, that it's the audience have crested and now it's dwindling. But I think there's a lot of competition. And so I think that affects it more than anything else. And my answer to that is, well, why don't you collaborate with a theater company? We have Shakespeare Company right around the corner. So we get their best actor, and he comes and meets Emily Dickinson, and we do a concert of all Emily Dickinson poetry. And it's still at an extremely high level. We have people in my community that have come from New York and from Boston now making their second homes and very good level singers. And the same with the dance companies. And there was an article that appeared in the Eastern ACDA Choral Journal that I wrote about this collaboration, because you can then also do concerts in unusual venues. That's something I read in Chorus America's Journal by the group in Philadelphia. I was very impressed with that. So we went and did a concert in Hancock Shaker Village in the Round Stone Barn, and a completely different audience than would ever come to a church to hear a concert, bringing Jewish music to a synagogue, you know, for one of their Friday evening services, another thing we plan, a concert in a museum, which I applied for a grant, sorry, you know, to go from gallery to gallery and get the audience to follow you. You know, just have to be innovative and creative, and you don't have to dumb down the music either. I mean, this is going to be Mendelssohn, this is going to be Monteverdi, this is, you know, major stuff. So I think it's just looking within your own community and seeing how you can share audiences. So that's just my comment.
Thank you. And now we are delighted to have a transitional ukulele song from Nick Page, which will bring us into our hors d'oeuvre and cocktail hour. Let's give all of the panelists one more hand.
I've written a lot of music. I've had over 100 commissions, one from a group in New England. And I have a little opera being performed at where? Lincoln Center in June. A little comic book opera for children's choirs. So I want to do a little children's song with you. I've never done this with a Mystic Chorale. I never would. Everyone repeat after me. And you got to use your hands. It's a children's song. Do you let the light in?
We let the light in.
Now you're going to lead this, so stand up. Do you let the light in?
Do you let the light in?
Do you let the light out?
We let the light out.
Do you shine?
We shine.
No, do you shine?
We shine.
Do you shine?
Do you shine?
Really shine.
Really shine.
Do you dance with the light?
Do you dance with the light?
Does the light dance with you?
Does the light dance with you?
Do you shine?
Do you shine?
Really shine.
Really shine.
All right, it's short. Repeat after me. Do you let the light in?
Do you let the light in?
And that's where you go like this. Here we go. Do you let the light in?
Do you let the light in?
Do you let the light out?
Do you let the light out?
Do you shine?
Do you shine?
Really shine?
Really shine?
Do you dance with the light?
Do you dance with the light?
Does the light dance with you?
Does the light dance with you?
Do you shine?
Do you shine?
Really shine?
Really shine?
Next part's just me. Do you shine with the light of the child? Do you shine with the light of the sun? Do your eyes shine, your nose and your toes? Does your soul shine? Do your highs and your lows? Do you let the light in?
Do you let the light in?
Do you let the light out?
Do you let the light out?
Really shine,
really shine.
Do you dance with the light?
Do you dance with the light?
Does the light dance with you?
Does the light dance with you?
Do you shine?
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 Do
you shine?
We had some harmony on this. Do you shine?
Do you shine?